to make our children spectators of war. But we must also contrive that they shall be secured against danger. Then all will be well.
True.
Their parents may be supposed not to be blind to the risks of war, but to know, as far as human foresight can, what expeditions are safe and what dangerous.
That may be assumed.
And they will take them on the safe expeditions and be cautious about the dangerous ones?
True.
And they will place them under the command of experienced veterans who will be their leaders and teachers?
Very properly.
Still, the dangers of war cannot be always foreseen. There is a good deal of chance about them.
True.
Then against such chances, the children must be at once furnished with wings, in order that in the hour of need they may fly away and escape.
What do you mean? He said.
I mean that we must mount them on horses in their earliest youth, and when they have learnt to ride, take them on horseback to see war. The horses must not be spirited and warlike, but the most tractable and yet the swiftest that can be had. In this way they will get an excellent view of what is hereafter to be their own business, and if there is danger, they have only to follow their elder leaders and escape.
I believe that you are quite right, he said.
Next, as to war. What are to be the relations of your soldiers to one another and to their enemies? I should be inclined to propose that the soldier who leaves his rank or throws away his arms, or is guilty of any other act of cowardice, should be degraded into the rank of a husbandman or artisan. What do you think?
By all means, I should say.
And he who allows himself to be taken prisoner may as well be made a present of to his enemies. He is their lawful prey, and let them do what they like with him.
Certainly.
But the hero who has distinguished himself, what shall be done to him? In the first place, he shall receive honor in the army from his youthful comrades. Every one of them in succession shall crown him. What do you say?
I approve.
And what do you say to his receiving the right hand of fellowship?
To that, too, I agree.
But you will hardly agree to my next proposal.
What is your proposal?
That he should kiss and be kissed by them?
Most certainly, and I should be disposed to go further and say, let no one whom he has a mind to kiss refuse to be kissed by him while the expedition lasts,
so that if there be a lover in the army, whether his love be youth or maiden, he may be more eager to win the prize of valor.
Capital, I said.
That the brave man is to have more wives than others has been already determined, and he is to have first choices in such matters more than others, in order that he may have as many children as possible.
Agreed.
Again, there is another manner in which, according to Homer, brave youths should be honored. For he tells how Ajax, after he had distinguished himself in battle, was rewarded with long chines, which seems to be a compliment appropriate to a hero in the flower of his age, being not only a tribute of honor, but also a very strengthening thing.
Most true, he said.
Then in this, I said, Homer shall be our teacher, and we too, at sacrifices and on the like occasions, will honor the brave according to the measure of their valor, whether men or women, with hymns, and those other distinctions which we were mentioning, also with seats of precedence and meats and full cups. And in honoring them, we shall be at the same time training them.
That, he replied, is excellent.
Yes, I said, and when a man dies gloriously in war, shall we not say, in the first place, that he is of the golden race?
To be sure.
Nay, have we not the authority of Hesiod for affirming that when they are dead, they are holy angels upon the earth, authors of good, averters of evil, the guardians of speech-gifted men?
Yes, and we accept his authority.
We must learn of the god how we are to order the sepulture of divine and heroic personages, and what is to be their special distinction, and we must do as he bids?
By all means.
And in ages to come we will reverence them, and kneel before their sepulchres as at the graves of heroes. And not only they, but any who are deemed preeminently good, whether they die from age or in any other way,
shall be admitted to the same honors.
That is very right, he said.
Next, how shall our soldiers treat their enemies? What about this?
In what respect do you mean?
First of all, in regard to slavery? Do you think it right that Hellenes should enslave Hellenic states, or allow others to enslave them, if they can help? Should not their custom be to spare them, considering the danger which there is that the whole race may one day fall under the yoke of the barbarians?
To spare them is infinitely better.
Then no Hellene should be owned by them as a slave. That is a rule which they will observe and advise other Hellenes to observe.
Certainly, he said, they will in this way be united against the barbarians and will keep their hands off one another.
Next, as to the slain. Ought the conquerors, I said, to take anything but their armor? Does not the practice of despoiling an enemy afford an excuse for not facing the battle? Cowards skulk about the dead, pretending that they are fulfilling a duty, and many an army before now has been lost from this love of plunder.
Very true. And is there not illiberality and avarice in robbing a corpse, and also a degree of meanness and womanishness in making an enemy of the dead body when the real enemy has flown away and left only his fighting gear behind him? Is not this rather like a dog who cannot get at his assailant, quarreling with the stones which strike him instead?
Very like a dog, he said. Then we must abstain from spoiling the dead or hindering their burial.
Yes, he replied, we most certainly must.
Neither shall we offer up arms at the temples of the gods, least of all the arms of Hellenes, if we care to maintain good feeling with other Hellenes. And indeed, we have reason to fear that the offering of spoils taken from kinsmen may be a pollution unless commanded by the god himself.
Very true.
Again, as to the devastation of Hellenic territory or the burning of houses, what is to be the practice?
May I have the pleasure, he said, of hearing your opinion?
Both should be forbidden, in my judgment. I would take the annual produce and no more. Shall I tell you why?
Pray do.
Why, you see, there is a difference in the names discord and war. And I imagine that there is also a difference in their natures. The one is expressive of what is internal and domestic, the other of what is external and foreign. And the first of the two is termed discord, and only the second war.
That is a very proper distinction, he replied.
And may I not observe with equal propriety that the Hellenic race is all united together by ties of blood and friendship, and alien and strange to the barbarians?
Very good, he said.
And therefore when Hellenes fight with barbarians, and barbarians with Hellenes, they will be described by us as being at war when they fight, and by nature enemies, and this kind of antagonism should be called war. But when Hellenes fight with one another, we shall say that Hellas is then in a state of disorder and discord, they being by nature friends, and such enmity is to be called discord.
I agree.
Consider then, I said, when that which we have acknowledged to be discord occurs, and a city is divided, if both parties destroy the lands and burn the houses of one another, how wicked does the strife appear? No true lover of his country would bring himself to tear in pieces his own nurse and mother. There might be reason in the conqueror depriving the conquered of their harvest, but still they would have the idea of peace in their hearts, and would not mean to go on fighting forever.
Yes, he said, that is a better temper than the other.
And will not the city which you are founding be a Hellenic city?
It ought to be, he replied.
Then will not the citizens be good and civilized?
Yes, very civilized.
And will they not be lovers of Hellas, and think of Hellas as their own land, and share in the common temples?
Most certainly.
And any difference which arises among them will be regarded by them as discord only, a quarrel among friends, which is not to be called a war.
Certainly not.
Then they will quarrel as those who intend some day to be reconciled.
Certainly.
They will use friendly correction, but will not enslave or destroy their opponents. They will be correctors, not enemies. Just so. And as they are Hellenes themselves, they will not devastate Hellas, nor will they burn houses, nor ever suppose that the whole population of a city, men, women, and children, are equally their enemies, for they know that the guilt of war is always confined to a few persons, and that the many are their friends. And for all these reasons they will be unwilling to waste their lands and raise their houses. Their enmity to them will only last until the many innocent sufferers have compelled the guilty few to give satisfaction. I agree, he said, that our citizens should thus deal with their Hellenic enemies, and with barbarians as the Hellenes now deal with one another. Then let us enact this law also for our guardians, that they are neither to devastate the lands of Hellenes nor to burn their houses. Agreed. And we may agree also in thinking that these, like all our previous enactments, are very good. But still I must say, Socrates, that if you are allowed to go on in this way, you will entirely forget the other question which at the commencement of this discussion you thrust aside. Is such an order of things possible? And how, if at all? For I am quite ready to acknowledge that the plan which you propose, if only feasible, would do all sorts of good to the state. I will add what you have omitted, that your citizens will be the bravest of warriors, and will never leave their ranks, for they will all know one another, and each will call the other father, brother, son. And if you suppose the women to join their armies, whether in the same rank or in the rear, either as a terror to the enemy, or as auxiliaries in case of need, I know that they will then be absolutely invincible, and there are many domestic advantages which might also be mentioned and which I also fully acknowledge. But, as I admit all these advantages and as many more as you please, if only this state of yours were to come into existence, we need say no more about them. Assuming, then, the existence of the state, let us now turn to the question of possibility and ways and means. The rest may be left. If I loiter for a moment, you instantly make a raid upon me, I said, and have no mercy. I have hardly escaped the first and second waves, and you seem not to be aware that you are now bringing upon me the third, which is the greatest and heaviest. When you have seen and heard the third, I think you will be more considerate and will acknowledge that some fear and hesitation was natural respecting a proposal so extraordinary as that which I have now to state and investigate. The more appeals of this sort which you make, he said, the more determined are we that you shall tell us how such a state is possible. Speak out, and at once. Let me begin by reminding you that we found our way hither in the search after justice and injustice. True, he replied. But what of that? I was only going to ask whether, if we have discovered them, we are to require that the just man should in nothing fail of absolute justice. Or may we be satisfied with an approximation, and the attainment in him of a higher degree of justice than to be found in other men? The approximation will be enough. We were inquiring into the nature of absolute justice, and into the character of the perfectly just, and into injustice and the perfectly unjust, that we might have an ideal. We were to look at these in order that we might judge of our own happiness and unhappiness according to the standard which they exhibited, and the degree in which we resembled them, but not with any view of showing that they could exist in fact. True, he said. Would a painter be any the worse because, after having delineated with consummate art an ideal of a perfectly beautiful man, he was unable to show that any such man could ever have existed? He would be none the worse. Well, and were we not creating an ideal of a perfect state? To be sure. And is our theory a worse theory because we are unable to prove the possibility of a city being ordered in the manner described? Surely not, he replied. That is not the truth, I said. But if at your request I am to try and show how and under what conditions the possibility is highest, I must ask you, having this in view, to repeat your former admissions. What admissions? I want to know whether ideals are ever fully realized in language. Does not the word express more than the fact? And must not the actual, whatever a man may think, always in the nature of things, fall short of the truth? What do you say?
I agree.
Then you must not insist on my proving that the actual state will in every respect coincide with the ideal. If we are only able to discover how a city may be governed nearly as we proposed, you will admit that we have discovered the possibility which you demand, and will be contented. I'm sure that I should be contented. Will not you?
Yes, I will.
Let me next endeavor to show what is at fault in states, which is the cause of their present maladministration, and what is the least change which will enable a state to pass from the turret form, and let the change, if possible, be of one thing only, or if not, of two. At any rate, let the changes be as few and slight as possible.
Certainly, he replied.
I think, I said, that there might be a reform of the state if only one change were made, which is not a slight or easy, though still a possible one.
What is it? He said.
Now then, I said, I go to meet that which I liken to the greatest of the waves. Yet shall the word be spoken, even though the wave break and drown me in laughter and dishonor, and do you mark my words?
Proceed.
I said, until philosophers are kings, or the kings and princes of this world have the spirit and power of philosophy, and political greatness and wisdom meet in one, and those commoner natures which pursue either to the exclusion of the other are compelled to stand aside, cities will never have rest from their evils, nor the human race, as I believe. And then only will this our state have a possibility of life and behold the light of day. Such was the thought, my dear Glaucon, which I would fain have uttered if it had not seemed too extravagant. For to be convinced that in no other state can there be happiness, private or public, is indeed a hard thing.
Socrates, what do you mean?
I would have you consider that the word which you have uttered is one at which numerous persons, and very respectable persons too, in a figure pulling off their coats all in a moment, and seizing any weapon that comes to hand, will run at you might and main before you know where you are, intending to do heaven knows what. And if you don't prepare an answer, and put yourself in motion, you will be paired by their fine wits, and make no mistake.
You got me into the scrape, I said.
And I was quite right. However, I will do all I can to get you out of it. But I can only give you goodwill and good advice, and, perhaps, I may be able to fit answers to your questions better than another. That is all. And now, having such an auxiliary, you must do your best to show the unbelievers that you are right.
I ought to try, I said, since you offer me such invaluable assistance.
And I think that, if there is to be a chance of our escaping, we must explain to them whom we mean when we say that philosophers are to rule in the state. Then we shall be able to defend ourselves. There will be discovered to be some natures who ought to study philosophy and to be leaders in the state, and others who are not born to be philosophers and are meant to be followers rather than leaders.
Then now for a definition, he said.
Follow me, I said, and I hope that I may in some way or other be able to give you a satisfactory explanation.
Proceed.
I dare say that you remember, and therefore I need not remind you, that a lover, if he is worthy of the name, ought to show his love, not to some one part of that which he loves, but to the whole.
I really do not understand, and therefore beg of you to assist my memory.
Another person, I said, might fairly reply as you do, but a man of pleasure like yourself ought to know that all who are in the flower of youth do something or other, raise a pang or emotion in a lover's breast, and are thought by him to be worthy of his affectionate regards. Is not this a way which you have with the fair? One has a snub nose, and you praise his charming face. The hook nose of another has, you say, a royal look, while he who is neither snub nor hooked has the grace of regularity. The dark visage is manly, the fair are children of the gods, And as to the sweet honey pale, as they are called, what is the very name but the invention of a lover who talks in diminutives and is not averse to paleness if appearing on the cheek of youth? In a word, there is no excuse which you will not make, and nothing which you will not say, in order not to lose a single flower that blooms in the springtime of youth. If you make me an authority in matters of love, for the sake of argument, I assent. And what do you say of lovers of wine? Do you not see them doing the same? They are glad of any pretext of drinking any wine. Very good. And the same is true of ambitious men. If they cannot command an army, they are willing to command a file. And if they cannot be honored by really great and important persons, they are glad to be honored by lesser and meaner people. But honor of some kind they must have. Exactly. Once more let me ask, does he who desires any class of goods desire the whole class or a part only? The whole. And may we not say of the philosopher that he is a lover not of a part of wisdom only, but of the whole? Yes, of the whole. And he who dislikes learning, especially in youth, when he has no power of judging what is good and what is not, such a one we maintain not to be a philosopher or a lover of knowledge, just as he who refuses his food is not hungry, and may be said to have a bad appetite, and not a good one? Very true, he said. Whereas he who has a taste for every sort of knowledge, and who is curious to learn and is never satisfied, may be justly termed a philosopher. Am I not right? Glaucon said, If curiosity makes a philosopher, you will find many a strange being will have a title to the name. All the lovers of sights have a delight in learning, and must therefore be included. Musical amateurs, too, are a folk strangely out of place among philosophers, for they are the last persons in the world who would come to anything like a philosophical discussion, if they could help, while they run about at the Dionysiac festivals as if they had let out their ears to hear every chorus. Whether the performance is in town or country, that makes no difference. They are there. Now, are we to maintain that all these and any who have similar tastes, as well as the professors of quite minor arts, are philosophers? Certainly not, I replied. They are only an imitation. He said, Who then are the true philosophers? Those, I said, who are lovers of the vision of truth. That is also good, he said, but I should like to know what you mean. To another, I replied, I might have a difficulty in explaining, but I am sure that you will admit a proposition which I am about to make. What is the proposition? That since beauty is the opposite of ugliness, they are two? Certainly. And inasmuch as they are two, each of them is one. True again. And of just and unjust, good and evil, and of every other class, the same remark holds. Taken singly, each of them is one. But from the various combinations of them with actions and things, and with one another, they are seen in all sorts of lights, and appear many. Very true. And this is the distinction which I draw between the sight-loving, art-loving, practical class, and those of whom I am speaking, and who are alone worthy of the name of philosophers. How do you distinguish them? He said. The lovers of sounds and sights, I replied, are, as I conceive, fond of fine tones and colors and forms and all the artificial products that are made out of them. But their mind is incapable of seeing or loving absolute beauty. True, he replied. Few are they who are able to attain to the sight of this. Very true. And he who, having a sense of beautiful things, has no sense of absolute beauty, or who, if another lead him to a knowledge of that beauty, is unable to follow, of such a one I ask, is he awake or in a dream only? Reflect. Is not the dreamer, sleeping or waking, one who likens dissimilar things, who puts the copy in the place of the real object? I should certainly say that such a one was dreaming. But take the case of the other, who recognizes the existence of absolute beauty, and is able to distinguish the idea from the objects which participate in the idea, neither putting the objects in the place of the idea, nor the idea in the place of the objects. Is he a dreamer, or is he awake?
He is wide awake.
And may we not say that the mind of the one who knows has knowledge, and that the mind of the other who opines only has opinion?
Certainly.
But suppose that the latter should quarrel with us and dispute our statement. Can we administer any soothing cordial or advice to him without revealing to him that there is sad disorder in his wits?
We must certainly offer him some good advice, he replied.
Come then, and let us think of something to say to him. Shall we begin by assuring him that he is welcome to any knowledge which he may have, and that we are rejoiced at his having it? But we should like to ask him a question. Does he who has knowledge know something or nothing?
You must answer for him.
I answer that he knows something.
Something that is or is not.
Something that is, for how can that which is not ever be known?
And are we assured, after looking at the matter from many points of view, that absolute being is or may be absolutely known, but that the utterly non-existent is utterly unknown?
Nothing can be more certain.
Good.
But if there be anything which is of such a nature as to be or not to be, that will have a place intermediate between pure being and the absolute negation of being.
Yes, between them.
And as knowledge corresponded to being and ignorance of necessity to not being, for that intermediate between being and not being, there has to be discovered a corresponding intermediate between ignorance and knowledge, if there be such?
Certainly.
Do we admit the existence of opinion?
Undoubtedly.
As being the same with knowledge or another faculty?
Another faculty.
Then opinion and knowledge have to do with different kinds of matter corresponding to this difference of faculties.
Yes.
And knowledge is relative to being and knows being.
But before I proceed further, I will make a division.
What division?
I will begin by placing faculties in a class by themselves. They are powers in us and in all other things by which we do as we do. Sight and hearing, for example, I should call faculties. Have I clearly explained the class which I mean?
Yes, I quite understand.
Then let me tell you my view about them. I do not see them, and therefore the distinctions of figure, color, and the like, which enable me to discern the differences of some things, do not apply to them. In speaking of a faculty, I think only of its sphere and its result, and that which has the same sphere and the same result, I call the same faculty, but that which has another sphere and another result, I call different.
Would that be your way of speaking?
Yes.
And will you be so very good as to answer one more question? Would you say that knowledge is a faculty, or in what class would you place it?
Certainly knowledge is a faculty, and the mightiest of all faculties.
And is opinion also a faculty?
Certainly, he said.
For opinion is that with which we are able to form an opinion.
And yet you were acknowledging a little while ago that knowledge is not the same as opinion.
Why, yes, he said. How can any reasonable being ever identify that which is infallible with that which errs?
An excellent answer, proving, I said, that we are quite conscious of a distinction between them.
Yes.
Then knowledge and opinion, having distinct powers, have also distinct spheres or subject matters?
That is certain.
Being is the sphere or subject matter of knowledge, and knowledge is to know the nature of being?
Yes.
An opinion is to have an opinion?
Yes.
And do we know what we opine? Or is the subject matter of opinion the same as the subject matter of knowledge?
Nay, he replied, that has been already disproven. If difference in faculty implies difference in the sphere or subject matter, and if, as we were saying, opinion and knowledge are distinct faculties, then the sphere of knowledge and of opinion cannot be the same. Then, if being is the subject matter of knowledge, something else must be the subject matter of opinion.
Yes, something else.
Well, then, is not being the subject matter of opinion? Or rather, how can there be an opinion at all about not being? Reflect. When a man has an opinion, has he not an opinion about something? Can he have an opinion which is an opinion about nothing?
Impossible.
He who has an opinion about some one thing.
Yes.
And not being is not one thing, but, properly speaking, nothing.
True.
Of not being, ignorance was assumed to be the necessary correlative. Of being, knowledge?
True, he said.
Then opinion is not concerned either with being or with not being.
Not with either.
And can therefore neither be ignorance nor knowledge?
That seems to be true.
But is opinion to be sought without and beyond either of them, in a greater clearness than knowledge, or in a greater darkness than ignorance?
In neither.
Then I suppose that opinion appears to you to be darker than knowledge, but lighter than ignorance.
Both, and in no small degree.
And also to be within and between them?
Yes.
Then you would infer that opinion is intermediate.
No question.
But were we not saying before that if anything appeared to be of a sort which is and is not at the same time, that sort of thing would appear also to lie in the interval between pure being and absolute not being, and that the corresponding faculty is neither knowledge nor ignorance, but will be found in the interval between them?
True.
And in that interval there has now been discovered something which we call opinion?
There has.
Then what remains to be discovered is the object which partakes equally of the nature of being and not being, and cannot rightly be termed either pure and simple. This unknown term, when discovered, we may truly call the subject of opinion, and assign each to their proper faculty, the extremes to the faculties of the extremes, and the mean to the faculty of the mean.
True.
This being premised, I would ask the gentleman who is of opinion that there is no absolute or unchangeable idea of beauty, in whose opinion the beautiful is the manifold, he, I say, your lover of beautiful sights, who cannot bear to be told that the beautiful is one, and the just is one, or that anything is one, to him I would appeal, saying, will you be so very kind, sir, as to tell us whether, of all these beautiful things, there is one which will not be found ugly? Or of the just, which will not be found unjust, or of the holy, which will not also be unholy.
No, he replied, the beautiful will in some point of view be found ugly, and the same is true of the rest.
And may not the many which are doubles be also halves, doubles, that is, of one thing and halves of another?
Quite true.
And things great and small, heavy and light, as they are termed, will not be denoted by these any more than by the opposite names?
True, both these and the opposite names will always attach to all of them.
And can any one of those many things, which are called by particular names, be said to be this, rather than not to be this?
He replied,
they are like the punning riddles which are asked at feasts, or the children's puzzle about the eunuch aiming at the bat, with what he hit him, as they say in the puzzle, and upon what the bat was sitting. The individual objects of which I am speaking are also a riddle, and have a double sense. Nor can you fix them in your mind, either as being or not being, or both, or neither.
Then what will you do with them?
I said. Can they have a better place than between being and not being? For they are clearly not in greater darkness or negation than not being, or more full of light and existence than being.
That is quite true, he said.
Thus, then, we seem to have discovered that the many ideas which the multitude entertain about the beautiful and about all other things are tossing about in some region which is halfway between pure being and pure not being.
We have.
Yes. And we had before agreed that anything of this kind which we might find was to be described as matter of opinion, and not as matter of knowledge, being the intermediate flux which is caught and detained by the intermediate faculty.
Quite true.
Then those who see the many beautiful, and who yet neither see absolute beauty, nor can follow any guide which points the way thither, who see the many just and not absolute justice, and the like, such persons may be said to have opinion, but not knowledge?
That is certain. But those who see the absolute and eternal and immutable may be said to know, and not to have opinion only?
Neither can that be denied. The one love and embrace the subjects of knowledge, the other those of opinion. The latter are the same, as I dare say you will remember, who listened to sweet sounds and gazed upon fair colors, but would not tolerate the existence of absolute beauty.
Yes, I remember.
Shall we then be guilty of any impropriety in calling them lovers of opinion rather than lovers of wisdom, and will they be very angry with us for thus describing them?
I shall tell them not to be angry. No man should be angry at what is true.
But those who love the truth in each thing are to be called lovers of wisdom, and not lovers of opinion.
Assuredly.
Book 6.
And thus, Glaucon, after the argument has gone a weary way, the true and the false philosophers have at length appeared in view.
I do not think, he said, that the way could have been shortened.
I suppose not, I said, and yet I believe that we might have had a better view of both of them if the discussion could have been confined to this one subject, and if there were not many other questions awaiting us, which he who desires to see in what respect the life of the just differs from that of the unjust must consider.
And what is the next question? He asked.
Surely, I said, the one which follows next in order. Inasmuch as philosophers only are able to grasp the eternal and unchangeable, and those who wander in the region of the many and variable are not philosophers, I must ask you, which of the two classes should be the rulers of our state?
And how can we rightly answer that question?
Whichever of the two are best able to guard the laws and institutions of our state, let them be our guardians.
Very good.
Neither, I said, can there be any question that the guardian who is to keep anything should have eyes rather than no eyes?
There can be no question of that.
And are not those who are verily and indeed wanting in the knowledge of the true being of each thing, and who have in their souls no clear pattern, and are unable, as with a painter's eye, to look at the absolute truth and to that original to repair, and having perfect vision of the other world, to order the laws about beauty, goodness, justice in this, if not already ordered, and to guard and preserve the order of them? Are not such persons, I ask, simply blind?
Truly, he replied, they are much in that condition.
And shall they be our guardians when there are others who, besides being their equals in experience and falling short of them in no particular of virtue, also know the very truth of each thing?
There can be no reason, he said, for rejecting those who have this greatest of all great qualities. They must always have the first place, unless they fail in some other respect.
Suppose then, I said, that we determine how far they can unite this and the other excellences.
By all means.
In the first place, as we began by observing, the nature of the philosopher has to be ascertained. We must come to an understanding about him, and when we have done so, then, if I am not mistaken, we shall also acknowledge that such a union of qualities is possible, and that those in whom they are united, and those only, should be rulers in the state.
What do you mean?
Let us suppose that philosophical minds always love knowledge of a sort which shows them the eternal nature, not varying from generation and corruption.
Agreed.
And further, I said, let us agree that they are lovers of all true being. There is no part, whether greater or less, or more or less honorable, which they are willing to renounce, as we said before of the lover and the man of ambition.
True?
And if they are to be what we were describing, is there not another quality which they should also possess?
What quality?
Truthfulness. They will never intentionally receive into their mind falsehood, which is their detestation, and they will love the truth.
Yes, that may be safely affirmed of them.
Maybe, my friend, I replied, is not the word. Say rather, must be affirmed. For he whose nature is amorous of anything cannot help loving all that belongs or is akin to the object of his affections.
Right, he said.
And is there anything more akin to wisdom than truth?
How can there be?
Can the same nature be a lover of wisdom and a lover of falsehood?
Never.
The true lover of learning then must from his earliest youth, as far as in him lies, desire all truth?
Assuredly.
But then again, as we know by experience, he whose desires are strong in one direction will have them weaker in others. They will be like a stream which has been drawn off into another channel.
True.
He whose desires are drawn towards knowledge in every form will be absorbed in the pleasures of the soul, and will hardly feel bodily pleasure. I mean, if he be a true philosopher and not a sham one.
That is most certain.
Such a one is sure to be temperate, and the reverse of covetous. For the motives which make another man desirous of having and spending have no place in his character.
Very true.
Another criterion of the philosophical nature has also to be considered.
What is that?
There should be no secret corner of illiberality. Nothing can be more antagonistic than meanness to a soul which is ever longing after the whole of things, both divine and human.
Most true, he replied.
Then how can he, who has magnificence of mind and is the spectator of all time and all existence, think much of human life?
He cannot.
Or can such a one account death fearful?
No, indeed.
Then the cowardly and mean nature has no part in true philosophy.
Certainly not.
Or again, can he who is harmoniously constituted, who is not covetous or mean, or a boaster, or a coward, can he, I say, ever be unjust or hard in his dealings?
Impossible.
Then you will soon observe whether a man is just and gentle, or rude and unsociable. These are the signs which distinguish even in youth the philosophical nature from the unphilosophical.
True.
There is another point which should be remarked.
What point?
Whether he has or has not a pleasure in learning. For no one will love that which gives him pain, and in which after much toil he makes little progress.
Certainly not.
And again, if he is forgetful and retains nothing of what he learns, will he not be an empty vessel?
That is certain.
Laboring in vain, he must end in hating himself and his fruitless occupation?
Yes.
Then a soul which forgets cannot be ranked among genuine philosophic natures. We must insist that the philosopher should have a good memory?
Certainly.
And once more, the inharmonious and unseemly nature can only tend to disproportion?
Undoubtedly.
And do you consider truth to be akin to proportion? Or to disproportion?
To proportion.
Then, besides other qualities, we must try to find a naturally well-proportioned and gracious mind, which will move spontaneously towards the true being of everything.
Certainly.
Well, and do not all these qualities, which we have been enumerating, go together? And are they not, in a manner, necessary to a soul which is to have a full and perfect participation of being?
They are absolutely necessary, he replied.
And must not that be a blameless study, which he only can pursue who has the gift of a good memory, and is quick to learn, noble, gracious, the friend of truth, justice, courage, temperance, who are his kindred?
The god of jealousy himself, he said, could find no fault with such a study.
And to men like him, I said, when perfected by years and education, and to these only you will entrust the state.
Here Adamantus interposed and said, To these statements, Socrates,
No one can offer a reply. But when you talk in this way, a strange feeling passes over the minds of your hearers. They fancy that they are led astray a little at each step in the argument, owing to their own want of skill in asking and answering questions. These littles accumulate, and at the end of the discussion, they are found to have sustained a mighty overthrow, and all their former notions appear to be turned upside down. And as if unskillful players of draughts are at last shut up by their more skillful adversaries and have no piece to move, so they too find themselves shut up at last, for they have nothing to say in this new game of which words are the counters, and yet all the time they are in the right. The observation is suggested to me by what is now occurring, for any one of us might say that although in words he is not able to meet you at each step of the argument, he sees as a fact that the votaries of philosophy, when they carry on the study, not only in youth as a part of education, but as the pursuit of their maturer years, most of them become strange monsters, not to say utter rogues, and that those who may be considered the best of them are made useless to the world by the very study which you extol. Well, and do you think that those who say so are wrong? I cannot tell, he replied, but I should like to know what is your opinion. Hear my answer. I am of opinion that they are quite right. Then how can you be justified in saying that cities will not cease from evil until philosophers rule in them, when philosophers are acknowledged by us to be of no use to them? You ask a question, I said, to which a reply can only be given in a parable. Yes, Socrates, and that is a way of speaking to which you are not at all accustomed, I suppose. I perceive, I said, that you are vastly amused at having plunged me into such a hopeless discussion. But now hear the parable, and then you will be still more amused at the meagerness of my imagination. For the manner in which the best men are treated in their own states is so grievous that no single thing on earth is comparable to it. And therefore, if I am to plead their cause, I must have recourse to fiction, and put together a figure made up of many things, like the fabulous union of goats and stags which are found in pictures. Imagine, then, a fleet or a ship, in which there is a captain who is taller and stronger than any of the crew. But he is a little deaf, and has a similar infirmity in sight, and his knowledge of navigation is not much better. The sailors are quarreling with one another about the steering. Everyone is of opinion that he has a right to steer, though he has never learned the art of navigation, and cannot tell who taught him or when he learned, and will further assert that it cannot be taught, and they are ready to cut in pieces anyone who says the contrary. They throng about the captain, begging and praying him to commit the helm to them. And if at any time they do not prevail, but others are preferred to them, they kill the others or throw them overboard, and having first chained up the noble captain's senses with drink or some narcotic drug, they mutiny and take possession of the ship and make free with the stores. Thus eating and drinking, they proceed on their voyage in such manner as might be expected of them. Him who is their partisan and cleverly aids them in their plot for getting the ship out of the captain's hands into their own, whether by force or persuasion, they compliment with the name of sailor, pilot, able seaman, and abuse the other sort of man, whom they call a good-for-nothing. But that the true pilot must pay attention to the year and seasons and sky and stars and winds, and whatever else belongs to his art, if he intends to be really qualified for the command of a ship, and that he must and will be the steerer, whether other people like or not, the possibility of this union of authority with the steerer's art has never seriously entered into their thoughts, or been made part of their calling. Now, in vessels which are in a state of mutiny, and by sailors who are mutineers, how will the true pilot be regarded? Will he not be called by them a praetor, a stargazer, a good-for-nothing? Of course, said Adamantus. Then you will hardly need, I said, to hear the interpretation of the figure which describes the true philosopher in his relation to the state, for you understand already. Certainly. Then suppose you now take this parable to the gentleman who is surprised at finding that philosophers have no honor in their cities, explain it to him, and try to convince him that their having honor would be far more extraordinary.
I will.
Say to him that, in deeming the best votaries of philosophy to be useless to the rest of the world, he is right. But also tell him to attribute their uselessness to the fault of those who will not use them, and not to themselves. The pilot should not humbly beg the sailors to be commanded by him. That is not the order of nature. Neither are the wise to go to the doors of the rich. The ingenious author of this saying told a lie. But the truth is that when a man is ill, whether he be rich or poor, to the physician he must go, and he who wants to be governed, to him who is able to govern. The ruler who is good for anything ought not to beg his subjects to be ruled by him. Although the present governors of mankind are of a different stamp, they may be justly compared to the mutinous sailors, and the true helmsmen to those who are called by them good-for-nothings and stargazers.
Precisely so, he said.
For these reasons, and among men like these, philosophy, the noblest pursuit of all, is not likely to be much esteemed by those of the opposite faction. Not that the greatest and most lasting injury is done to her by her opponents, but by her own professing followers, the same of whom you suppose the accuser to say that the greater number of them are arrant rogues, and the best are useless, in which opinion I agreed.
Yes.
And the reason why the good are useless has now been explained?
True.
Then shall we proceed to show that the corruption of the majority is also unavoidable, and that this is not to be laid to the charge of philosophy any more than the other?
By all means.
And let us ask and answer in turn, first going back to the description of the gentle and noble nature. Truth, as you will remember, was his leader, whom he followed always and in all things. Failing in this, he was an impostor, and had no part or lot in true philosophy.
Yes, that was said.
Well, and is not this one quality, to mention no others, greatly at variance with present notions of him?
Certainly, he said.
And have we not a right to say in his defense that the true lover of knowledge is always striving after being? That is his nature. He will not rest in the multiplicity of individuals, which is an appearance only, but will go on. The keen edge will not be blunted, nor the force of his desire abate, until he have attained the knowledge of the true nature of every essence by a sympathetic and kindred power in the soul, and by that power drawing near and mingling and becoming incorporate with very being, having begotten mind and truth. He will have knowledge, and will live and grow truly, and then, and not till then, will he cease from his travail.
Nothing, he said, can be more just than such a description of him.
And will the love of a lie be any part of a philosopher's nature? Will he not utterly hate a lie?
He will.
And when truth is the captain, we cannot suspect any evil of the band which he leads.
Impossible.
Justice and health of mind will be of the company, and temperance will follow after?
True, he replied.
Neither is there any reason why I should again set in array the philosopher's virtues, as you will doubtless remember that courage, magnificent, apprehension, memory, were his natural gifts. And you objected that, although no one could deny what I then said, still, if you leave words and look at facts, the persons who are thus described are some of them manifestly useless, and the greater number utterly depraved. We were then led to inquire into the grounds of these accusations, and have now arrived at the point of asking, why are the majority bad? Which question of necessity brought us back to the examination and definition of the true philosopher.
Exactly.
And we have next to consider the corruptions of the philosophic nature, why so many are spoiled, and so few escape spoiling. I am speaking of those who were said to be useless but not wicked. And when we have done with them, we will speak of the imitators of philosophy. What manner of men are they who aspire after a profession which is above them and of which they are unworthy, and then by their manifold inconsistencies bring upon philosophy and upon all philosophers that universal reprobation of which we speak? What are these corruptions? He said. I will see if I can explain them to you. Everyone will admit that a nature having in perfection all the qualities which we required in a philosopher is a rare plant which is seldom seen among men. Rare indeed. And what numberless and powerful causes tend to destroy these rare natures. What causes? In the first place, there are their own virtues, their courage, temperance, and the rest of them, every one of which praiseworthy qualities, and this is a most singular circumstance, destroys and distracts from philosophy the soul which is the possessor of them. That is very singular, he replied. Then there are all the ordinary goods of life, beauty, wealth, strength, rank, and great connections in the state. You understand the sort of things. These also have a corrupting and distracting effect. I understand, but I should like to know more precisely what you mean about them. Grasp the truth as a whole, I said, and in the right way. You will then have no difficulty in apprehending the preceding remarks, and they will no longer appear strange to you. And how am I to do so? He asked. Why, I said, we all know that all germs or seeds, whether vegetable or animal, when they fail to meet with proper nutriment or climate or soil in proportion to their vigor, are all the more sensitive to the want of a suitable environment, for evil is a greater enemy to what is good than to what is not. Very true. There is reason in supposing that the finest natures, when under alien conditions, receive more injury than the inferior, because the contrast is greater. Certainly. And may we not say, Adamantus, that the most gifted minds, when they are ill-educated, become preeminently bad? Do not great crimes and the spirit of pure evil spring out of a fullness of nature ruined by education rather than by any inferiority, whereas weak natures are scarcely capable of any very great good or very great evil? There I think that you are right. And our philosopher follows the same analogy. He is like a plant which, having proper nurture, must necessarily grow and mature into all virtue, but, if sown and planted in an alien soil, becomes the most noxious of all weeds, unless he be preserved by some divine power. Do you really think, as people so often say, that our youth are corrupted by sophists, or that private teachers of the art corrupt them in any degree worth speaking of? Are not the public who say these things the greatest of all sophists? And do they not educate to perfection young and old, men and women alike, and fashion them after their own hearts? When is this accomplished? He said. When they meet together, and the world sits down at an assembly, or in a court of law, or a theater, or a camp, or in any other popular resort, and there is a great uproar, and they praise some things which are being said or done, and blame other things, equally exaggerating both, shouting and clapping their hands, and the echo of the rocks and the place in which they are assembled redoubles the sound of the praise or blame. At such a time, will not a young man's heart, as they say, leap within him? Will any private training enable him to stand firm against the overwhelming flood of popular opinion? Or will he be carried away by the stream? Will he not have the notions of good and evil which the public in general have? He will do as they do, and as they are, such will he be. Yes, Socrates, necessity will compel him. And yet, I said, there is a still greater necessity, which has not been mentioned. What is that? The gentle force of attainder, or confiscation, or death, which, as you are aware, these new sophists and educators, who are the public, apply when their words are powerless. Indeed, they do, and in right good earnest. Now, what opinion of any other sophist, or of any private person, can be expected to overcome in such an unequal contest? None, he replied. No, indeed, I said. Even to make the attempt is a great piece of folly. There neither is, nor has been, nor is ever likely to be, any different type of character which has had no other training in virtue but that which is supplied by public opinion. I speak, my friend, of human virtue only, What is more than human, as the proverb says, is not included. For I would not have you ignorant that, in the present evil state of governments, whatever is saved and comes to good is saved by the power of God, as we may truly say.
I quite assent, he replied.
Let me crave your assent also to a further observation.
What are you going to say?
Why, that all those mercenary individuals whom the many call sophists and whom they deem to be their adversaries do, in fact, teach nothing but the opinion of the many, that is to say, the opinions of their assemblies, and this is their wisdom. I might compare them to a man who should study the tempers and desires of a mighty, strong beast who is fed by him. He would learn how to approach and handle him, also at what times and from what causes he is dangerous or the reverse, and what is the meaning of his several cries, and by what sounds, when another utters them, he is soothed or infuriated. And you may suppose further that when, by continually attending upon him, he has become perfect in all this, he calls his knowledge wisdom, and makes of it a system or art, which he proceeds to teach, although he has no real notion of what he means by the principles or passions of which he is speaking, but calls this honorable and that dishonorable, or good or evil, or just or unjust, all in accordance with the tastes and tempers of the great brute. Good he pronounces to be that in which the beast delights, and evil to be that which he dislikes. And he can give no other account of them, except that the just and noble are the necessary, having never himself seen, and having no power of explaining to others the nature of either, or the difference between them, which is immense. By heaven, would not such a one be a rare educator?
Indeed he would.
And in what way does he who thinks that wisdom is the discernment of the tempers and tastes of the motley multitude, whether in painting or music or finally in politics, differ from him whom I have been describing? For when a man consorts with the many, and exhibits to them his poem, or other work of art, or the service which he has done the state, making them his judges when he is not obliged, the so-called necessity of Diomede will oblige him to produce whatever they praise. And yet the reasons are utterly ludicrous which they give in confirmation of their own notions about the honorable and good. Did you ever hear any of them which were not?
No, nor am I likely to hear.
You recognize the truth of what I have been saying.
Then let me ask you to consider further whether the world will ever be induced to believe in the existence of absolute beauty rather than of the many beautiful, or of the absolute in each kind rather than of the many in each kind.
Certainly not.
Then the world cannot possibly be a philosopher.
Impossible.
And therefore philosophers must inevitably fall under the censure of the world.
They must.
And of individuals who consort with the mob and seek to please them?
That is evident.
Then, do you see any way in which the philosopher can be preserved in his calling to the end? And remember what we were saying of him, that he was to have quickness and memory and courage and magnificence. These were admitted by us to be the true philosopher's gifts.
Yes.
Will not such a one from his early childhood be in all things first among all, especially if his bodily endowments are like his mental ones?
Certainly, he said.
And his friends and fellow citizens will want to use him as he gets older for their own purposes?
No question.
Falling at his feet, they will make requests to him and do him honor and flatter him because they want to get into their hands now the power which he will one day possess.
That often happens, he said.
And what will a man such as he be likely to do under such circumstances? Especially if he be a citizen of a great city, rich and noble, and a tall, proper youth. Will he not be full of boundless aspirations, and fancy himself able to manage the affairs of Hellenes and of barbarians, and having got such notions into his head, will he not dilate and elevate himself in the fullness of vain pomp and senseless pride?
To be sure, he will.
Now, when he is in this state of mind, if someone gently comes to him and tells him that he is a fool and must get understanding,
which can only be got by slaving for it.